to share time with not only our Alaskan soldiers, but several soldiers from other communities. How grateful they were was unbelievable.
Senator Mark Begich visits troops in Afghanistan. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 25th of May. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the state Supreme Court decides against forced medication for an Anchorage man.
At this point, his life is much better. I mean, he's still angry at what's been done to him over the last 30 years.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Award-winning news to get you out of bed in the morning. The Alaska Morning News and the Alaska Economic Report bring you the information you need for the day.
Governor Sarah Palin is asking the federal government for help with recovery efforts after heavy flooding this spring. Palin sent a letter officially requesting a federal disaster declaration for the spring floods. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, sent preliminary damage assessment teams into the field last week, and they are working their way down the Yukon and Kuskokwim rivers, village by village. Palin said FEMA's research validates the state's findings. She said the next step in the rebuilding process is to request federal assistance. The state's release says nearly 300 buildings and miles of roads have been damaged by heavy flooding, and hundreds of Alaskans are without homes. Senator Mark Begich is in Afghanistan with four other senators, meeting with soldiers and government officials. Details about the trip are being kept under wraps, but it's clear the group, all Democrats, is being sold on the Obama administration's plan to increase U.S. troop presence. Begich is on the Senate Armed Services Committee. Today he told a news teleconference that the group had met with Afghani President Karzai, as well as military commanders and troops. Some of the troops were Alaskans, though security considerations prevented the group from traveling to where the Army's 425th Airborne from Fort Richardson is stationed.
I was unable to go to the 425, and that was due to the there was a transition of authority in that area, and the risk level was too high. I will tell you, the security was unbelievable, and one of the areas we went to was Helmand Province, which is in the southern province of Afghanistan, a very highest casualty area and fatality area we currently have.
Helmand is on the border of Pakistan and is one of the areas into which the Taliban retreated when U.S. and other forces invaded. It is thought to provide a major corridor for moving arms and insurgent forces across the border. Begich said the terrain is forbidding.
We think in Alaska that our mountains are rough and tough. The terrain here is unbelievable. Besides being desert and lots of areas, hot and long distances between settlements, but also the mountainous areas are just unbelievable, the terrain that has to be covered.
Begich says he's encouraged by what he saw, and it seemed the troops were heartened to see that Congress has not forgotten them.
It was very encouraging to talk to Alaskans, and we celebrated there with, you know, obviously it's Memorial Day weekend, and being there to share time with not only our Alaskan soldiers, but several soldiers from other communities. How grateful they were was unbelievable. To have five U.S. senators, 1/20th of the United States Senate visiting, was very encouraging to them.
Begich also released a statement about North Korea's latest underground detonation and missile launch, saying it underscored the importance of the Fort Greely missile interceptor base. He said he will, quote, continue working in the Senate to ensure that it is fully operational. Last week, Missile Defense Commander General Patrick O'Reilly told a Senate committee that President Obama's budget would reduce spending on missile defense, in part by halting construction of a new missile silo field at Fort Greely. The The state Supreme Court has set new guidelines for giving psychotropic drugs to people who don't want to take the medication. The case involved William Bigley, an Anchorage man hospitalized nearly 80 times over 30 years and who was diagnosed as paranoid schizophrenic. The court described his history as a revolving door of arrest, hospitalization, medication, and relapse. He had previously been given psychotropic medication but always stopped taking it, afraid he was being poisoned and denying he had any mental problems. The court agreed that he suffered from side effects of the medication. When yet another round of medication was ordered in May of last year, Bigley refused. Neither he nor attorney James Gottstein was allowed to see the documentation the court would use to justify the use of the drug. Gottstein suggested community support as a less intrusive alternative to medication. Anchorage Superior Court approved the medical order, but also ordered it delayed, pending a Supreme Court decision. Although he was medicated one more time since the appeal, he has now gotten the support he desired. Gottstein says that without the medication, Bigley is doing much better.
At this point, his life is much better. I mean, he's still angry at what's been done to him over the last 30 years, which really has pretty much destroyed his life. But it's, you know, he's not being locked up and drugged against his will, at least for the last 3 months. And he's got a reasonably nice place to live, and he's got this support system around him. So I think his life is far better than it has been for some time.
The court ruled that the state did not recognize the due process rights for Bigley prior to the decisions to medicate him, and it outlined what steps need to be taken to assure those rights in the future. State attorneys representing the Alaska Psychiatric Institute say it's too soon to determine the effect of the decision. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a unique place to create and sell art in Kotzebue.
My carvings were very primitive, but I got better and better. And within 2 years, I was able to put a person's face on wood.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Want to break your tobacco addiction? Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-888-842-QUIT. Register for free Quit Line counseling and nicotine replacement patches. The combined counseling and patches increase your chances of quitting for good. Trained quit coaches will help you set a quit date and send you information. Free quit services are available to all Alaskans. This message is from the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line, 1-888-842-7848.
The search is continuing today for a missing climber on Mount McKinley. Gerald Myers began his bid for the summit from the 14,200-foot camp last Tuesday. He was sighted above Denali Pass at 18,200 feet later that same afternoon. Myers was climbing by himself. An individual climber was observed on a summit ridge the next afternoon, but park officials can't be confirmed the climber was Myers. Aerial spotters on board two U.S. Army Chinook helicopters yesterday were unable to view elevations above 17,000 feet because of weather. The annual conference of the Center for Ocean Law and Policy ended in Seward over the weekend. The conference included an international mix of lawyers, scientists, policymakers, and others. They discussed how nations work together on commercial trade, border protection, and other marine issues. The center's director, John Norton Moore, helped to draft most of the Law of the Sea Treaty, which outlines specifics in just those issues. But the treaty has not been ratified by the United States. Moore says its future looks good for eventual passage.
I think it will go through the Senate this time. I'm very optimistic. It's simply a matter of the Senate having time to vote on it at this point, and we have a president strongly supporting it, and the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Senator Kerry, strongly supporting it. I think we have the votes in the Senate, and I think it will go through in this Congress. I certainly hope so.
There were several speakers that say there is a misconception in the public about the Arctic. Moore says the misconception is that nations are in a growing conflict over the Arctic.
And that, in fact, there is very substantial cooperation at an operational level, for example, Coast Guard to Coast Guard, and that governments are working closely together to try to resolve the remaining issues of boundary problems, for example, and others.
Moore emphasizes that the five Arctic nations and the total of eight nations with interest in the Arctic are working on cooperative solutions. There aren't very many places in the world where you can walk along a beach and stumble across a tusk from a woolly mammoth. But the hills and beaches around Kotzebue are constantly revealing ancient treasures like these. Artists from around the region use the material, along with whalebone, walrus ivory, and wood, to craft intricate masterpieces. Now Kotzebue has a unique space where they can sell their work and also create it. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
Most artists discover their passion early in life, but Ross Schaefer didn't know he was a carver until he was 40 years old. The former Northwest Arctic borough mayor was used to spending a lot of time hunting with his snow machine, but suddenly he was sidelined by a back injury that required surgery.
I said to my wife, "Boy, what am I going to do?" She says, "Oh, get your tools and start carving." Looked at her. I went back out and got my tools and started trying to carve, and I cut myself numerous times because I didn't know how to use the tools right. My carvings were very primitive, but I got better and better. And within 2 years, I was able to put a person's face on wood.
Now, it's hard to imagine Schaefer without a carving tool in his hand. On this day, he's putting the finishing touches on a giant wood mural that shows a group of caribou crossing the Noatak River. With a metal tool, he carves away long, thin strips of cedar to put some texture in the sky.
The yellow cedar smells so good. As soon as you start cutting it, you can smell it. See, I'm starting to cut too deep, so I got to go the other way. The grain is the other side.
Schaefer works with all kinds of exotic material, like woolly mammoth, whalebone, and ivory. But he prefers the simplicity of wood, even though it's the one thing he can't find close to home. Schaefer often trades for the material with people in villages up the Kobuk River, where there are trees.
I hunt seals here, and then I send them up there, and they send me the wood.
How much wood do you get for a seal?
I just ask for one log, which is plenty, you know.
Schaefer works in a public studio he helped design and build. It's the back room of Kotzebue's Selenich Art Center. The building opened 2 years ago with a gallery out front where artists from around the region can sell their art. In the back is a space for artists to work. Schaefer says the idea first came up years ago when he was borough mayor.
We thought at the borough that one of the best ways to provide economic development for this whole region was to do it in the arts and crafts, because each village has certain artists and people that do not only artwork but crafts like baskets up in the Kobuk area.
So far, Schaefer says the art center is working pretty well. The staff are careful to stock only quality items to keep the inventory moving. A lot of the business comes from traveling nurses, tourists, or executives who drop in from NANA, the regional corporation. But Schaefer says the nationwide recession has hurt sales.
Well, you know, it was working very well until our economy went to pot, you know, and as you know, people are not using their money to buy things now, so it's slowed down a lot.
Schaefer says larger art pieces especially are tougher to sell now. He started to concentrate more on small items like earrings, but he's optimistic things will eventually turn around, and the center will soon have a much larger pool of prospective buyers. Kim Franklin is the administrator at Selenich. She's building a website that will allow visitors to take a virtual tour of the gallery and buy the art online.
We want to market more outside of Kotzebue, and it should help.
Franklin also wants to get more of the community involved with Selenich, with classes that will help keep the art and craft traditions in the region alive.
And we have an elder teach a class on muckluck sewing, how to make mucklucks to hats, to mittens, and utdukluks and stuff like that. And then we also want to do that on the arts and crafts side, on carving, etching, sled building, whatever traditional things that there's a need or interest in.
Seeing the Art Center expand and mature has been gratifying for artist Ross Schaefer. He says there will always be room for improvement, but for now, he's happy Selenich is giving more artists like him in the region the chance to make a living doing what they love. For APRN, I'm Annie Feit.
This season was a bit of a letdown for herring gill netters at Seymour Canal off southern Admiralty Island. Catches dropped off dramatically after the first day of the fishery in late April, and the opportunity for a second opening didn't pan out earlier this month. KFSK's Matt Lichtenstein has the story.
This year's quota at Seymour Canal was the third largest ever, but the fleet only landed about 60% of it. With a big quota and expectations for a good price, there was plenty of participation. 81 permit holders took part in the harvest, which the Department of Fish and Game opened on the morning of April 30th. By the following day, gill netters had caught about 820 tons of the 1,471-ton limit, but catches dropped dramatically, and on May 2nd, the third day of the Seymour opening, conditions prompted Fish and Game to open up the other gillnet herring fishery at nearby Hobart Bay off the mainland. As the fleet moved over to Hobart, Fish and Game decided to close the Seymour fishery. Biologist Kevin Monagle manages Seymour each year.
The catch rates had been horrible for a day and a half. The last day and a half of the opening, and there was some remnant spawn, no fish to be seen. And so we closed the fishery, and of course, there was some confusion after Hobart was done, whether Seymour was absolutely totally done, or whether we were on 2-hour notice, or whether there would be another opening or not.
Monagle flew that Monday and saw some light spot spawns, and an industry pilot observed more that same evening. At the time, those were indications that there might be more opportunity to fish coming up.
This was after we received a report of a good biomass of fish in the area. So with 600 tons on the table, we just remobilized and headed back out to Seymour.
And so did a lot of the fleet, as the department put the fishery back on notice that Tuesday, the 5th of May. The department continued its aerial and sonar surveys of the grounds, and about 45 gill netters waited, but after 3 days of searching, they never found a second mass of herring large enough to have a second opening. So on the early afternoon of May 7th, Fish and Game announced that Seymour would remain closed for the season. The 1,471-ton quota was based on roughly 14-15% of the estimated population of mature herring at Seymour. Fish and Game had projected that population at about 10,000 tons this past winter. Shortly after calling the season, Monagle said there was still a big question mark as to whether that population forecast actually panned out. He expected to know more after completing the department's dive survey of the area this month.
I suspect, there's a couple different things we saw this year. We saw a lot of smaller fish in the population. If the forecast was a little off and we didn't quite have the numbers of 8-year-old plus fish in the mix and a lot more sixes and sevens and maybe even fives, it's entirely possible that we did get the biomass. They just wasn't all catchable.
In at least the past decade, this fleet has successfully taken or come pretty close to taking its quota until this year. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, now offering several webinars each month. More information at grantstation.com. And by EcoTrust, working to encourage economic development, healthy communities, and healthy salmon in the Copper River watershed. On the web at ecotrust.org/copper river.
The city of Kodiak's pilot study to determine the best way to deal with biosolids left over from the sewage treatment plant has gotten underway. A composting project set to continue through the summer is intended to convert large amounts of sludge into usable compost. KMXT's Eric Wander has more.
In January 2007, the borough notified the city that biosolids generated from the city's sewage system would not be accepted at the borough landfill indefinitely, according to city manager Amy Kenyazhovsky. Kenyazhovsky said the project is now in its very beginning stages.
The city is currently collecting brush and wood and the wood chipper that they need to break down these large chunks of wood and blow down and whatnot is on site, and they've started chipping, and they add the wood chips to the sludge. They mix those with what they call amendments to begin the process of creating compost, and they'll be doing that over the summer.
Kenyazhovsky said the compost must meet Department of Environmental Conservation guidelines in order for the pilot study to be considered successful and a viable option for future long-term implementation. She also said the availability of sufficient amounts of wood is a concern.
They already knew it was going to be difficult to get enough wood to convert to wood chips to use for, because this is a huge amount, a volume of sludge that is generated. But ADEC has, you know, these requirements in order to make sure that there's been enough sanitation and removal of harmful components that it can safely be used.
According to Kenyazovsky, between 250 and 400,000 pounds of sludge are generated in Kodiak each month. Kenyazovsky said similar projects have been successful elsewhere in the state, noting Fairbanks as an example. She said composting and testing will continue over the summer, after which a final report will be issued by spring 2010. I'm Eric Wander.
Fairbanks area government is moving ahead with laws to eliminate polluting wood and coal-fired heaters. The Fairbanks City Council forwarded an ordinance aimed at smoky outdoor boilers. Co-sponsor Mayor Terry Sturrell says it would ban installation of new hydronic heaters as of July 1st and use of existing units after a five-year phase-out period.
We're really viewing it as a nuisance. We have had people call us from different neighborhoods complaining about, you know, the quality of their air as a result of their neighbors. These hydronic heaters were really designed for rural areas. And if you look at the concentration in the city, it's really not a rural area.
Sturrell says the city is trying to be proactive, knowing that borough action is forthcoming. Smoke from wood and coal-burning appliances has been documented as a significant contributor to local air pollution. Borough air quality specialist Jim Connor says mobile testing units have shown dangerously high readings in areas near wood and coal-fired boilers.
They can be extremely high. If you remember the smoke from that summer wildfire that we had several years ago, when you couldn't see a third of a mile, and that's what we're finding around some of these units.
Connor says environmental conditions and operating practices affect the amount of smoke produced. Local air quality has regularly violated new, stricter federal fine particulate emission standards the borough has to comply with. Borough Mayor Jim Whitaker says a two-part ordinance banning use of non-EPA-compliant wood and coal heaters is expected out soon.
One component is a negative component, which says you must comply within certain time guidelines. And the second component is relative to tax credits or outright buybacks that may be offered.
The state legislature passed a law this past session that allows municipalities to offer tax breaks to residents who swap out polluting heaters for cleaner burning models. While it's believed fewer than 30 outdoor wood or coal boilers are in the city, hundreds more are operating borough-wide, as well as thousands of wood stoves, including many older non-compliant models. Wood and coal burning proliferated in the interior last year when oil prices spiked. Fairbanks Food Bank Director Samantha Kirstein says a coal-fired boiler saved the food bank a third of its heating bill this past winter. The food bank is located in South Fairbanks, where lots are generally bigger. Kirstein says not all areas should be treated the same when it comes to wood and coal-burning regulations.
I think there's a difference between commercial installations and small residential area installations, and I hope that we can demonstrate that difference.
Kirstein says she hopes exemptions will be allowed for commercial and industrial wood and coal boiler users. She was one of the few business representatives that voiced concern before the Fairbanks City Council on the proposed legislation to ban the wood and coal boilers. The council has scheduled public comment and a vote on the ordinance for its next meeting, June 8th. Borough legislation is expected to be introduced in coming weeks. Homer writer Miranda Weiss's first book, Tide, Feather, Snow, just came out in hardback and is already garnering high praise. Publishers Weekly calls it a deeply honest memoir. KBBI's Casey Kelly spoke with the author and has this story.
Tide, Feather, Snow is the story of Miranda Weiss's move to Homer and how, as a girl from the suburbs of Washington, D.C., she was forced to adapt to a new way of life. In the opening chapter, Setting the Net, she writes that growing up, her main skills were playing Chopin nocturnes and getting good grades in school. None of that seemed to matter, she says, once she moved to Alaska.
You know, I was amazed at how incompetent I felt. And this book sort of arose out of my obsession with trying to puzzle through how a place could make me feel so confused and kind of incompetent and yet so completely romanced all at the same time.
Part of the struggle, she says, was meeting so many people who seemed so capable and who had so many skills that she didn't seem to have. Weiss says she met boat builders and homesteaders and gardeners who all possessed a wealth of local knowledge. Meanwhile, she was having trouble with simple terminology.
There were so many words to learn, no fewer than 36 to describe sea ice, including pancake, rind, fast, and brash, and countless more to describe boat types and parts. John learned new terms quickly and used them easily, confidently. For me, learning each word became a small act of appropriation, and I felt my mouth form around these foreign sounds tentatively.
John, which is not his real name, was Weiss's boyfriend at the time that she moved to Homer and a central character in the book. One of the major conflicts is how easily John is able to pick up that local knowledge that Weiss wants to have.
Being with somebody who just so quickly and so easily, from my point of view, adapted to this place and where I felt, you know, so sort of muddled and out of place for much longer than he did.
The tension eventually contributes to her and John breaking up, but along the way, Weiss does learn how to do a lot of the things that she'd been obsessed with in the beginning of the book. She even has some uniquely Alaskan experiences, like dip netting for Kenai River red salmon and skinning a sea otter. And Tidefeather Snow includes some beautiful descriptions of the rugged terrain and wildlife of Alaska. Weiss started working on the book as a creative writing student at Columbia University in New York City, so she says she made an effort to describe things in a way that people who have never been to the state would understand.
You know, I think I strive to make unexpected comparisons and to compare landscapes to, or aspects of landscapes and aspects of the natural world to other things that people would recognize.
These days, Weiss has moved back to Homer, gotten married, and is still writing. Next month, she'll take part in the Kachemak Bay Writers Conference in Homer. She says even though she's gained some of that local knowledge in the 10 years since she moved to Alaska, she continues to seek out new experiences and new ways to challenge herself.
You know, life here and life anywhere is a challenge, and if you're not sort of growing and taking on new things, then you get stagnant. So I don't think I'm ever going to feel like I'm on some plateau where I've mastered everything in my life, but certainly I feel a lot more at home here than I did when I first arrived.
Weiss had a reading and a book release party last week in Homer and a reading this weekend in Soldotna. She starts a West Coast book tour this week, which includes stops in Seattle, Portland, and San Francisco. She'll be back in Alaska on May 28th for a reading and book signing event at Tidal Wave Books in Anchorage. In Homer, I'm Casey Kelly.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Eric Wander in Kodiak, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ben Stanton in Seward, and Casey Kelly in Homer. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau, Steve Heimel from Anchorage, and Annie Fite from Kotzebue. Our engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Have a great evening.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Pennair, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com. Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. And by
the UAF College of Engineering and Mines, providing early registration for fall engineering classes at 1-877-474-7390. Information at uaf.edu/cem.
Sooner or later, the H1N1 swine flu will come to Alaska. There are simple ways to avoid catching or spreading this or any virus. Wash your hands often with soap and water or use a waterless hand cleaner. Cough into your sleeve or into a tissue rather than your hands. Stay at home if you're sick and contact your health care provider. More information is available on the state website at pandemicflu.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.